Hello and welcome to today's EurActive hybrid event, Fueling Change, Biodiesel and the Future of Sustainable Transport in the EU. Welcome to all of you joining at home and also to those of you joining here in the room. My name is Dave Keating. I'm a journalist based here in Brussels. I'm coming at you live from the EurActive studios in the heart of the EU quarter, and I'll be guiding us through today's conversation about how biodiesel fits into the EU's efforts to tackle climate change. Now, we know we're now coming to the end of a legislative term where we've seen really a marathon of climate legislation since 2019, since the unveiling of President Ursula von der Leyen's Green Deal. The EU has committed to being carbon neutral by 2050 and adopted various pieces of sector-specific legislation as part of the Fit for 55 package in order to get the EU to its goals. Now, these include a lot of different areas, from decarbonizing transport to enhancing energy efficiency in buildings, you name it. This legislation still moved on, all of these implementing pieces of legislation, even during the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic troubles that followed. The EU was really resolute about making these massive changes happen. So now most of these legislative pieces have been adopted. We're now moving more toward the implementation phase and the transposition phase in national governments. And on today's panel, we're going to be talking about where sustainable biodiesel fits in to all of this and the wider picture. We'll also be looking at what recent regulatory changes will mean for biofuels. Now, we know that in November of last year, an amendment to the Renewable Energy Directive entered into force, which increased the EU's ambition to integrate energy from renewable sources into the EU's energy mix. And this had really big implications for the transport sector. The text includes a binding target for member states to either reduce the greenhouse gas intensity of the energy used by 14.5% or achieve a 29% share of renewables within the final consumption of energy by 2030. There's also more granular targets. The text set a target of a 4.5% with double counting, or 2.25% in real energy terms, for advanced biofuels such as waste and residue-based biofuels. So on this panel, we're going to be talking about whether biofuels have the potential to decarbonize the transport sector, to get the EU to those ambitious climate goals, and what the key policy challenges are right now in order to maximize their potential. How efficient and cost-effective are biofuels for the decarbonization process? And how effective has the revised Renewable Energy Directive been so far, both for biofuels and for really getting the transport sector to those decarbonization topics? Now, we have a great panel with us here today. Let me introduce you to them now. Here to my left, we have Zlatko Kregar, who's Policy Officer for Sustainable and Intelligent Transport at the European Commission's Transport Department. We have Liberal Czech MEP Andrej Kovarik, who is a member of the Transport Committee in the European Parliament. We have Luke Pelkmans, who is a technical coordinator at the Bioenergy Technology Collaboration Program at the International Energy Agency, the IEA. We have Luce Knotter, who is a partner at Studio Gearup, an Amsterdam-based consultancy working with green startups. And we have Dickon Posnet, who is president of the European Biodiesel Board, which represents biodiesel producers. Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us here today for this discussion. Now, you guys here in the room and also watching at home will be able to ask the panelists questions yourself. You're going to use Slido for that. So whether you're here in the room or watching online, you're going to want to scan this QR code, and you can put your questions in right there. I will get them here on my tablet, and I will ask them to the panelists toward the end of the panel. I see everybody dutifully copying that QR code right now, which is great. You can go ahead and put questions in now if you want to. It's great for me to know already what's on your minds, and that way I can be ready fully to make sure that we get your questions answered. So Zlatko, let's start with a question for you. I mentioned all of the legislative changes that we've seen during this term with Fit for 55 implementing the Green Deal's goals. So how are these changes going to affect the biofuel sector and in particular biodiesel?
So thanks for having me here. It's a privilege to be able to explain and a bit to go more in depth on Commission's positions and explain our proposals and our now already adopted proposals. So as you mentioned, the Fit for 55 is a big legislative train, and several pieces of legislation there do have a direct influence on the transport sector and on especially on the biodiesel sector. So I would say that in DG Move, we were very glad that to have two proposals directly linked with, let's say, renewable low carbon fuels, the Refuel EU Aviation, Fuel EU Maritime. They are addressing the demand side for various renewable fuels. And obviously, both sets of legislation, both proposals and now regulations are in the bigger framework of the Renewable Energy Directive, which has also been revised. Obviously, the sector-specific regulations for aviation and maritime are looking at the specifically for these sectors, but the Renewable Energy Directive, which increases the ambition of the general usage of renewable energy, which includes biofuels as well, has been strengthened. So these three pieces of legislation are the most crucial ones that have come in the last period as part of the Green Deal, and we expect them to have an influence in increasing the usage of renewable energy, definitely, especially in transport in these modes.
Andre, in the European Parliament, you guys have been busy passing all of this legislation. How would you say the Fit for 55 laws have impacted biofuel sector? And would you say they've now created a predictable framework for companies and investors looking to invest in biofuels?
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. And also thanks for the invite. Indeed, I think the European Commission kept us busy for quite some time. And even though we are still before actually at the end of this parliamentary mandate, we still have a lot of things on our table and at least to finalize and pass it through the votes in the committees and in plenary. To your question, how the Fit for 55 package impacted the sector and created a predictable environment, I think to a certain extent, yes. But in my view, in a certain extent, no. And I think there is still an ambition that we could have, as co-legislators, but also the Commission initially, addressed better in terms of providing more opportunities for the biofuel sector. I would only agree with my colleague from the European Commission in terms of maritime aviation. I think the grounds are built, providing new, let's say, opportunities for biofuel sector to tap into these very important parts of the transport sector. But I think we were, in my view, slightly less ambitious when it comes to the road transport. We've been through the discussion on the reduction of CO2 emissions for passenger cars, light vehicles, heavy-duty vehicles, and we've been through this debate a couple of times on and on. Very often, even through the votes, there was not a political majority providing for, I would say, more predictable and sustainable provisions in terms of acknowledging the role of biofuels in reducing the CO2 emissions in those sectors. We will have a report coming from the Commission on the heavy-duty vehicles next year. I think this is actually a good opportunity to assess to what extent biofuels and biodiesel can actually contribute by using the existing technology of combustion engine by providing, let's say, better results in terms of CO2 emission reduction. And I really hope we can do basically the same thing for the passenger cars and light-duty vehicles in 2026 when the review clause kicks in for the CO2 emissions, because I really believe that there is a role that biofuels can play in very effective, but at the same time achievable and realistic CO2 emission reduction in a near future if accompanied by relevant legislation.
Luke, you've been looking a lot at the potential for biofuels and the different research initiatives that are happening there. What does the science tell us about the potential for biodiesel to contribute to meeting these EU climate goals?
Okay. Thanks for the question. Also, thanks for asking me to be here. I would like to take a step back, actually, to what IEA has been doing also into the modeling and their approach towards 2050 to decarbonize or to reach net zero. And transport is one of the more difficult sectors to deal with because it's so reliant on fossil fuels at the moment. So it's kind of a defossilization that we need in that sector. And looking at the roadmap, we actually need to do four things and which are really complementary. So we have to look at the demand for transport, having mobility plans, having modal shifts. So first work on demand, then on the efficiency of the vehicles that we have around. So that's the second thing. The third is electrification, which is really very important. And things are moving fast in terms of the car fleets. That is important, but also we have to realize that it takes time. So at the moment still, I think about 98% of the vehicles which run around here in Europe have a combustion engine and need a fuel for that. And then also complementary next to the electrification is renewable fuels. So it's actually these four components which are complementary and need to be done together. And they all have their different phases. So if you are looking at the current fleet, the immediate impact that you can have is replacing a fuel in an existing vehicle. So that's really an immediate impact you can have with biofuels. On the longer term, you can also think about e-fuels. I think that's another discussion. You need a lot of hydrogen, a lot of CO2 for that. But this compatibility with the current fleet is really important. What I also like to say is in terms of potential, so IEA has also looked at what could biofuels contribute in 2050 also in the transport sector, and they end up to something between 10-15% of the energy in transport. It's not something linear, it's something a little bit more bumpy, so we can use biofuels really in the shorter term to replace fossil fuels in the existing fleets. Once the electrification comes in the road transport, you would need less biofuels in that sector and more shifting in biofuels to aviation and marine fuels. But this is something which should happen gradually. So the first you need to do is really transport, focus on transport, road transport, where you have really options to do things immediately. That can shift gradually, but what's also important to have this role of biofuels in the current sector is looking at the feedstocks which are there. So we have the current biofuels. They use the current feedstock, vegetable oils or used cooking oils in terms of biodiesel. But we also need to go beyond that. So we need to go towards a very broader feedstock base to produce biofuels. And particularly diesel fuels will be very important also because we have the heavy duty sector, which is much more difficult to decarbonize. So advanced biofuels is also very important to pick that up to broaden the feedstock base.
Luce, when you're talking to companies, do you get the impression that the Fit for 55 laws that have been passed, are they leading to excitement? Are people feeling like this is going to lead to new opportunities for companies wishing to invest in climate-friendly transport measures?
Well, it's a yes and a no, because it's an incredible volume that needs to be realized. It's really, really incredible. We've done some numbers when we took a little bit the Neste factory in Rotterdam with an output of 1.2. billion liters a year, I think about. You need only to meet a sub-mandate that cannot be used, which is a different feedstock base. You need about 12 new Rotterdam Neste facilities to produce that. But that's not enough because we have increased the ambition to minus 14.5%. So we need about the same volume. On top of that, that's not the volume of the mandate, but it's that's to meet the minus 14.5, because you've actually, the European Commission, in the legislation, the other feedstock bases have been kept. So we have to build on these, and then we have to have about 12 Nestes for the sub-mandate, another 12 for the other volume, and then I'm counting on 56 billion. Do I say it right now? A billion, million, yeah, right? I've read this right, yeah? Battery electric vehicles on the road. And I don't know if you know how many we have today. We are about, maybe you know this numbers, 4.7, are we there about? So we've got 5 years. And, you know, we need this to meet the minus 14.5%. We need to reach the 56 billion battery electric vehicles on the market. Because if we don't meet that number, we even need more renewable fuels on the market from a base, a feedstock base that has perspectives to grow, and that's actually the advanced feedstock base just mentioned by Luc. So if I then say, do I see enthusiasm? Well, the numbers are big, but the problem is a little bit that we have no synergies enough between the mandates for aviation and maritime and the chemical sector. So we need now, we have to ask now the industry to invest on a spike of volumes in renewable fuels for the road sector. Then we want to electrify it and electrify it. You can't find investors to actually invest for a maybe 10-year period in an advanced technology. So this is what is holding investors at the moment maybe back. We need, in the new legislative term, a better connection with ambition in the other legislation, chemical industry, green chemistry goals, aviation higher ambition, and maritime needs a higher ambition.
Mm. Well, speaking of looking ahead to the next legislative term, Dickon, yesterday EBB published its manifesto for what it would be looking for from legislators over the next term. So what would companies in the biodiesel sector like to see from this next upcoming term?
Thanks, Dave. I'm going to come to that in a second. I just wanted to comment on a couple of the points, which are really interesting listening. I love coming last here. It's an advantage. But and listening to the IEAs and the comments, actually, you're speaking our language in many ways in terms of the joint approach that needs to happen both with what's available now, and we might put biodiesel in that category, and what's got to come in the future. And that's something we might pick up on later, but there's some big issues there. And the numbers you're quoting and the investors, because we're an industry association full of biodiesel producers, HVO producers, and we're very close to what the investors are thinking at the moment. So these are important. I should probably say, like the public broadcasters say, you know, Neste, we're glad to say, is one of our members. I think they're here today as well. There are other producers available. But So coming back to the question, in the manifesto, so there are three key asks we've got in the manifesto. One is consistency. That won't come as any surprise. It's something that we've asked to the European Commission many times, and we're sort of very observant of how that affects us. Consistency is not something we see inconsistencies in a number of the things. We see the tax regulations are not as consistent with the RED. The CO2 standards for heavy-duty vehicles, etc., aren't necessarily consistent with RED, etc. So those kind of things we'd really like to see ironed out. And secondly, and linked to that, is and it comes perhaps a little bit from the ECHA report as well, is that we've got objectives and we've got the sights set out to 2050 for some sectors, but we've only got 2030 really for the road. And so this is another sort of inconsistency that we're going to be pushing for. And the third part of it is trade consistency and trade fairness. So the EBB stands up for the biodiesel industry and takes the responsibility of observing, watching, monitoring, and addressing any trade imbalances. It's a big part of our business at the moment, and we are working very hard on a number of different fronts on that case. And the reason is that it is having, and has in the past, a huge impact on the viability of our businesses. So it's not just a nice to have. This is equally as important as the legislative incentives as defending ourselves against imbalances and unfair trade practices.
Let's talk a bit. So far, we've focused mainly on the climate challenges, which biofuels and biodiesel in particular can address. But let's talk about another big concern of the EU at the moment, and that is energy security and strategic autonomy. So Zlatko, in DG Move, you have these, you know, there's the climate department and the commission that is just dealing with climate stuff. But you guys in DG Move, climate is one of the concerns that you deal with, and you deal with a whole wide variety of things. And we know that this is an important issue to President von der Leyen. Where would you say that biofuels and biodiesel in particular fit into this quest for strategic autonomy, particularly when we're thinking about food and feed strategic autonomy? And how can it contribute to this energy security concern that we have?
Yeah, well, in general, it is clear that things have changed so much in the past couple of 4 years now. We can see it's March 2020. 4 years ago, we had a double crisis basically coming up. We saw with COVID and we saw with the Russian aggression in Ukraine that our energy security and the security of global value chains and stability of value chains is not something that we can take for granted, that's for sure. Biofuels or in general broader term of renewable fuels, they will substitute our imported fossil fuels. So it is clear that this is clear for decades. Europe is dependent on fossil imports from across the globe. And if we can substitute, Repower EU plan is about substituting fossil fuels from Russia. But in general, we have one of the key aspects of every impact assessment that the Commission did for Fit for 55 for decarbonization also looked at increasing energy security, because we will be reducing our fossil fuel imports. So there is a place here for renewable fuels and biofuels in particular, and that always plays into our analysis, I would say.
Andre, put this question to you as well. Do you see biofuels as being part of the solution to energy sovereignty, or are the numbers just not big enough to truly play a role there?
Well, I think they have a role to play. Indeed, at this point, we are not at the stage where we can fully substitute the demand for fossil fuels by alternatives. But I think it's more the trend. But that would also depend on the availability of technology, on the advances in the development in the sector, but also production capacities within the European Union, which would need to ramp up. That would also mean to sort of a focus some part of our efforts on that sector, because obviously the scaling up, it's very easy to write down in a strategy, but in practical terms, especially in European Union, it may be quite difficult actually to end up in this situation. But I think, I mean, we are currently for these past 2 years of the Russian aggression in Ukraine on this trajectory of cutting off some provisions of the fossil fuels coming, namely from Russia, reorienting the supply chains, but also working on strategic autonomy. I don't think so, and I'm not an energy expert in general. I don't think that we would be able to cover all our needs by European production only. But I think already decreasing significantly our dependency on unreliable partners, providing us with energy that we need, would also contribute, I think, importantly to the, let's say, more strategically autonomous European Union in general. But I think the key in here would be actually to be able to focus on not only the development of the science, but also in practical terms, development of production of capacity in the sector. And as we see also currently, for instance, in the defense industry, we have issues to cope within the European Union, and I think this should be also maybe for the next mandate part of our efforts in the EU.
Dickon, how does the biodiesel sector view its role, both in energy security, but also in this idea of food and feed strategic autonomy?
Overall, then, for biodiesel, first of all, it plays its role, its part, and we are very conscious that it is only a part. But that doesn't diminish how important it is. And I think this is another message that we also have for the regulators, is that, and it's difficult, let's face it. We'd love to have, you know, the silver bullet that will replace fossil fuel, and away we go. And generally speaking, policymakers tend to like that. Well, let's pour all our efforts there. We tend to, you know, if we want an electric car, we tend to be all in favor of electric car and forget everything else. We have to be able to step back from that. There has to be sort of a holistic view taken, and I know this is what you were talking about, Luke, and the IEA, but the only then can you apportion, make sure that the efforts to incentivize all these options are there. So biofuels are a part, a very important part, especially here and now. I'm not saying in 2050 it's going to be as important as, you know, but it is now. And it's equally important for the biodiesel industry to have that support now. So while, and I'm coming back to a familiar theme, I'm afraid, but while we see the urgency to drive future fuels, future SAF, electrification, it's got to happen, and it's hard work to develop that and get the infrastructure in place. But you take your eye off the ball of the fuels that are displacing fossil fuel, very efficiently, by the way, at the moment, then investors will stop doing it. By the very nature, we need those incentives. The reason for those incentives have not gone away. The fundamental structure of this market is, and this isn't just criticism, it's just a reality, you know, the oil companies supply the fuels. They need to be mandated to do renewable fuels because it's not in their, generally speaking, in their interests. So that hasn't gone away. We've got to keep those incentives coming, and so that's why that, you know, we really do plea that the eye is not taken off the eye of biodiesel. To go on to your second point in terms of crop-based fuels. The same very much goes for that. I mean, personally, I come from a company, we're waste-based biodiesel. But I'm a huge believer in the comparator should be fossil fuel. And in the biodiesel world, it should be fossil diesel. Anything that's better than that should be maximized, in my view. Now, yes, it gets more complicated, and there's various debates that have happened in ILUC, et cetera. But likewise, the biodiesel industry, and this is something we are getting better at, but we have perhaps not been so good in the previous years, is explaining the advantages of crop-based biodiesel, the protein additionalities, and this all comes out in our manifesto as well, which you can see online. But there's real advantages to it. Advantages which I think would be a mistake to lose. And those are advantages which we're not seeing, for example, in Refuel EU, and we're not seeing in Fuel EU Maritime, where, for reasons which I still haven't had a clear answer from the authorities on, they've decided that the sustainability of biofuels is different, or the criteria should be different, depending on whether it goes into an aeroplane or a truck or a ship. And I just don't see the logic on it. None of us really understand that logic. So we're also pushing for equality of understanding of sustainability. We've got certification schemes, we've got sustainability measurements, greenhouse gas calculations. And based on these, I think we should be able to be brave enough to say, it's better than fossil, let's use it and maximize it.
Let me put that question directly to Zlatko. So should the sustainability of a fuel be based on the transport mode that it's being put into?
Well, obviously the final outcome is the process of co-decision that brought us to where we are. But in general, the the principle is that we look, of course, at the greenhouse gas intensity, but also as you hinted out, these were difficult discussions on ILUC, and these were not just touched upon. They're the core of the criteria, effectively. And the overall, all our three legislations that you touched upon here on fuel, refuel, and RED, they're all in the same framework, to say it simply. And well, we have been trying, and in the whole all three co-decision processes, to be clear where we are. The final outcome might, of course, for the biodiesel industry. You will see differences, but we see very much the underlying, not just the underlying, the whole concept is clear. So in a sense, while there are differences, the main message is going from stemming from the RED and then to the refuel and fuel EU regulations. And I will hint that, I mean, just continuing our discussion, is that this is the principle that has been applied in all iterations of the Renewable Energy Directive, the principle of looking at the best scientific knowledge from the field on the impact of various technologies, because the broad biodiesel sector has so many technologies they're sometimes overlapping in their coverage, sometimes not, completely different feedstocks and completely different processes on how to get them. So it was always, I wouldn't call it a struggle, it was always a process that as we move along that we find the best way of how to maximize the greater goals of greenhouse gas reductions and energy security, and with minimizing the external effects, externalities. And this has been applied so far.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Can I just come back a little bit on that? Because one of the arguments that I heard was used in those decisions was a concern about fraud. Now, I've always felt that if somebody is doing something illegal, you shouldn't ban the use of that product just to stop the crime. You know, you shouldn't stop diamonds being made because they're being nicked out of a shop. You police it better. And what the Commission has done is nearly introduced the union database, improve the voluntary schemes, and I think there's a lot more work, and we're working closely with the Commission on this. And combating fraud, which is a huge issue, which we do need to get better and better at. But let's assume, shall we, that the union database is going to be in place and it's going to be effective. Does that fraud, do you still see that as a reason also underlying some of your deliberations? Because...
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. Of course, I'm from DG Transport, so we are kind of the more towards the end usage than to the sourcing, and I know it's difficult to find one commission official that covers the multitude of options here. But I would say, I mean, it's all in the scale of the problem and in the scale of the issue that you're facing. So. Improving the database, yes, but I mean, there are also always considerations of fundamental nature. You used touched upon the diamonds. I mean, completely unrelated, but when we have an issue, and it was decades ago, on imports of diamonds, you would basically, even though I'm sure that there were traders who had nothing to do or but you would have blanket or more kind of wider restrictions on the imports. Of course, as it improves, you go back. But just by the core concept is there's always a fair player, let's say it like that, that might be covered for time being or with a blanket restriction, but it was introduced for a reason. We had instances, maybe too many, I would say, that we just it didn't fit into the legal framework that we have here.
Luke, as we've just had alluded to here, these types of sustainability concerns over ILUC and also over food versus fuel have led to a lot of regulatory fluctuation over the past 20 years here in the EU and also in other regimes globally. Do you feel that this issue is at least relatively resolved, let's say here in the EU, for instance, with the reforms that have been made? Are we likely to see a more predictable regulatory structure now because these concerns have been addressed, at least legislatively, or do you think there's still some way to go there?
I think that there's still some way to go, and the question is, how far do you go indeed to rule out ILUC risks? I think what the Commission has done well also is to look at what has happened in the past 15 years, from 2008 more or less. How did crops for biofuels, how did the area, what kind of area expansion did you have? Did it go into high carbon areas? Did you have land use change in those? And I looked into the different feedstocks and looked into what effect did they have. And I think you qualified palm oil at the moment as a high ILUC risk feedstock. So I think looking back on what happened is much better than trying to model the world and see what impact it has. So I think that's a positive thing. What I do have a concern is that any land use in future is kind of ruled out, land use to produce feedstocks, because there's lots of options to produce feedstocks with a low ILUC risk. And I think that should be expanded much more, that option of also in aviation and maritime. I think they restrict it really a lot. They should look at, are there ways to produce feedstocks with a very low ILUC risks? And I'm thinking of lands which are in not really used at the moment, on sequential crops, intercropping, things which really don't have a much big impact on food production, but do give you an extra potential. I think a lot of the potential that IEA has calculated is also from cropping, from growing energy crops, doesn't matter if it's oil-based or other, but on lands which are not the fertile lands, but the lands where you don't really compete with food. So I think this low ILUC risk feedstock, I think that is something that we should really look into more in detail.
Luce, when you're talking to companies about these sustainability issues, do you get the sense from them that they feel like, okay, this is settled now, I feel confident to make this investment because we have a good regulatory regime around this, or do you sense still some nervousness?
Well, if I pick up from where Luke had at it, marginal lands are not the easiest lands. So if you are a farmer, and I know there's here farmer representatives as well, you if you're starting and want to create a business case on a marginal land, that's a hard job. And then you actually have to look, what are then the incentives? The common agricultural policy is not incentivating it much. The RED, yes, maybe, but they might need to find each other here. And that's, I think, what we could do for now with having the legislation in place, that we try to look, what's the business case for this marginal land? Again, it's not the easiest land. Easier is what actually Luke was mentioning, is already on existing lands to intercropping. That's the kind of easy things, because there you've got already the logistics, there you've got already the practices. That's the easiest bit. So what now happens, to my knowledge, please tell me if I'm wrong, this intercropping is now allowed for HEFA production, for SAF production, sustainable aviation fuels, but is still kept now for the road. Sustainable aviation fuels, how I'm really happy with the mandate, but it's quite a modest mandate. The big volumes are in roads. So here we have now a possibility to expand feedstocks also for the existing industry that is actually kept for road, where we have the biggest need of volumes on the short term. So if I come back then to the feedstock policy, I agree a little bit here with Dickon. We might need to reconsider the feedstock policy here. And that's creating a lot of investment risks, perceived investment risks. on better sustainability principles. There's now too many things that try to be addressed now in the legislation or in the Annex 9A or B feedstock list. We try to do too much on a list based, and I think we need to go back to really have a much better integrated sustainable feedstock policy.
Andre, perceived investment risks can be a problem when legislation is constantly changing. How do you view where we are, where we're at right now in terms of tackling these issues? And in the next term, what do you see coming in terms of defining some of these sustainability issues?
Well, first of all, I agree with the fact that, I mean, once the regulatory framework is set, we should try to stick to it in order to provide for better predictability. But it doesn't really mean that we should not address some concerns that are still existing in there. As I mentioned in my introductory remarks, for instance, the issues of possible use of the CO2 neutral fuels or including the biofuels in the road transport, both heavy duties and light duties and passenger cars. This is something where we still have work to do. But I think just maybe following up to what has been said, I think, well, first of all, the next mandate will be a lot about the implementation. We were just discussing that before the start of this debate. There's a lot of has to be done in terms of secondary legislation standards in all these issues. But I think, as you rightly pointed out, it was actually a marathon of legislation that has been passed through this mandate, but not definitely. Taking into account all the variables into one package. So let's say the Common Agriculture Policy was done before the Fit for 55 package was completed, and it was not fully consistent. The next mandate will be about reviewing the Common Agricultural Policy. So should we make sure that these are aligned and that it actually provides a consistent regulatory framework for the sector on all fronts? I think yes, that should be also our ambition. But I would be at the same time not the one calling for revisiting every piece of Fit for 55 package, because I think that would only create more uncertainties in the market. So yes, we can have some targeted modifications, which I think still they're possible with the review clauses and those areas which are still open. But I think if we say that this is our, let's say, reference point, the benchmark, let's also make sure that all other relevant pieces of legislation are actually fit, so that they don't create loopholes, inconsistencies, and create some areas where also the sector can have doubts about the future prospects.
In your view, does the CAP need to be reopened and revised before the actual time for the next MFF to address this lack of compatibility you were just referenced?
I think normally, I'm not expert in agriculture here, but I think this is foreseen for the next mandate. So I think this should be the steps taken within the next 5 years, so that both the MFF and the new the new agriculture policy or the revised agriculture policy fits together as well.
Okay. Well, let's take some questions that have come in from the audience. Thanks for lots of great questions here. I'm going to start off with a question for Dickon. So this question is from Andrea Canzano. Are there enough feedstock volumes to satisfy the industrial capacity that's going to be built for biodiesel production? So with all the plans there, is there enough feedstock to justify it?
I mean, this question is one that goes round and round, and it's been asked more and more frequently as as the obligations levels go up, and rightly so. But there isn't a clear answer on it. There's also questions, just to add to the confusion, there's questions, because I've just been asked a question in the UK, you know, is there enough availability to increase mandate such and such? And the availability means what? It means whatever parameters you want to set, global availability, or it depends on what your mandate sets. And I think to a large extent, this has been proven to be true. Now, there is a limit. Clearly, there is a limit. Somewhere out there's a limit. But so far, what we've found, and someone who's been in the business for nearly 20 years now, whenever a mandate has been set, whenever an authority has asked industry and set in place some kind of incentive mechanism and obligation, industry has turned up. You talked about the Neste Rotterdam plant. There's many examples of that. And there's good business reasons why that was done. We've announced a quadrupling of our capacity in Amsterdam. And this will be happening all the time. So industry will respond. Our message to the policymakers is don't be shy of asking industry to respond. Now, as I said, there is a limit somewhere, but none of us actually know where that is. But I think when we get close to it, that we will. And the other thing is, which is important in this, is we're talking about feedstocks frequently because we're a big market. We're sucking in feedstocks from around the world. The rest of the world is, like America's doing the same thing. They've now got their own obligations in the RFS. But you've got other countries in Asia, perhaps, where they're supplying a lot of feedstock and maybe biofuels for the European market. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops. But ultimately, there is going to be a limit somewhere. But I think we're a long way from reaching that limit. And certainly, when you're talking about the future fuels coming in, and in the shipping world of methanol, ammonia, whatever it may be, and in the SAF, I think, I come back to that for the refuel EU aviation. If the incentive is good enough and strong enough, and we want to get e-fuels in SAF quicker or more of them, industry will respond to those. And the quicker those happen, the less dependent you are on, say, the biomass-based.
Luke, what's your view on this feedstock issue?
I may want to respond also in terms of biodiesel feedstocks, because there's really a lot of attention for used cooking oil and animal fats from all kinds of regions also, particularly because these are double counted towards the target. But again, our colleagues at IEA have done analysis and they say, well, this is kind of a feedstock where you bump into kind of a crunch, a feedstock crunch. And it means that you're going towards the limit. You'll have to import it from all regions out of the world. You bump into competition for the same feedstock from aviation, from the road sector, and also prices go up. And if these prices of used cooking oil are higher than virgin oils, you're kind of in a strange market at that time. So I'd like to warn for that also for the sector, the industry sectors of. If everybody goes for the used cooking oil option, that's not going to work. So there are limits to that, and we can reach that sooner than we want, I think. So making the step towards, well, from used cooking oil and from the known technologies that we have to process vegetable oils, going towards more advanced technologies where you can have a much broader feedstock base, I think that is really a crucial thing that we have to address now, so not wait until we bump into a limit, but really now, and that we can expand the feedstock base. And that is a really crucial thing.
Did anyone else want to come in on the feedstock issue?
Yeah, I so much agree with Luke here. But we count on the biodiesel industry. If that volume falls away, then the pressure is even higher on those first-of-the-kind facilities that often only produce a small volume, then we really get into trouble. So we need the biodiesel industry to keep steady, basically. That's just something. If that falls away, getting difficult. It's already difficult, but then it's really getting difficult.
And there's friction between what you're saying, Luke, and the risks, you know, and your articulating a nervousness about what might happen. But to hold back, I mean, I think we should defend against the scary bits, like, is it going to drive crazy fraud and things? Defend against that. Put things in place so it's policed properly. And this industry is 100% behind that, certainly in the EBB. We want to stop that so that we can then just say, go out and get as much genuine wastes genuine sustainable feedstocks of any type, maximize it so that it's sustainable, not hold back when there's still another, you know, China could produce another 50% again of what it's already producing. Brazil, Africa, other places where this is still untapped to some degree. We just don't want to be held back by that. And this is why we feel caps are a negative. They are a really big negative indicator for investors. And if we want to maximize it and do as much now as we can so that we don't have to do so much in the future, then we shouldn't be restricting, I think, the investors in this industry.
Well, on the subject of fraud, we have a question here for Zlatko. The question is from Sean Delaney. Will the European Commission improve its transparency means to combat suspected fraudulent used cooking oil imports?
I will have to defer this question because DG Energy is looking at the details. I just do not know, other than the general line that you heard on the stage, that we want to reduce fraud.
Anybody on that specific issue about the used cooking oil imports? We go to the next question then. Let's go to a more general question here. This one might be a good one for Luke. The question is from Wang Tao. Will sustainable aviation fuels made from biosource contribute most to carbon reduction in 2050?
Okay. Well, there is this question of how we see the balance between the different sectors, but what is clear is that the aviation fuel will definitely rely a lot on sustainable aviation fuel. So a big part of the defossilization or decarbonization of aviation will rely on sustainable aviation fuel, which doesn't mean that the volume of which is still in the road transport will be smaller there. But the role in the absolute energy demand in road transport will be like a few percentage still, or maybe 5%. But in aviation fuels will be 50% maybe. When you talk about biofuels, but of course aviation doesn't consume so much energy as the road transport. Something I want to point out also is when you look at the technologies, also in HVO technologies, in Fischer-Tropsch technologies, when they focus themselves on aviation fuel production, they usually also have quite a lot of diesel as a side product. So actually the two go hand in hand, and that's also an interesting evolution.
Maybe I can add to that, because in DG Move for our regulations for refuel and fuel EU maritime, we decided also to support as much as possible the expansion of production of SAFs and maritime fuels through an industrial alliance, renewable and low carbon fuels value chain alliance. And there we actually see that yes, for instance, while focus is on aviation fuel, there will be byproducts by pure chemistry and how refining process works. Often when I talk about the alliance, I'm adamant that is focused on aviation maritime fuels, but the production itself obviously just will lead to different levels of fuels, which will maybe some can be taken by the maritime sector, but not in SAF. So this alliance also I might add when I'm on the topic is also addressing some of these competition and cost concerns, because we are trying to boost the production immediately, which links to what Dikon was saying about the immediacy effects, the targets do not seem very strict in 2025 or very ambitious. They are progressing, and we are starting from a very low base in aviation and maritime. So there is really a business case for investors to come in and try to tap either biostock or we are also looking at e-fuels as well. But to tap it, to use it as soon as possible in these two sectors.
Okay, the next question I think is best for Zlatko, but if anyone else wants to come in as well, it refers back to what we were talking about before with the sustainability definitions. Yeah. So this question is from Andrea Canzano. The latest update of Annex 9A/9B left a lot of questions open on why there has been a differentiation for intermediate crops based on N use, or SAF versus non-SAF. Can you comment on that?
Yeah. First, one broader comment is that whenever we do a delegated legislation, it's always, and this is especially sitting next to a co-legislator, it is important that we follow what is in the main legislation. So red is clear on advanced and basically on the criteria are all set in red. It's just that for aviation sector, we have seen that the pathways are less mature for production, so that they were considered that they merit the inclusion into part A, and obviously, even though the fuel is the feedstock is the same, but the production itself is what it makes it merits the inclusion into the advanced part.
Okay, so yeah, go ahead. You look hesitant, but.
I'm a bit hesitant here. I mean, if you produce HVO, HEFA, the other that's aligned, that's actually what Luke was just mentioning. So honestly, here I have some troubles following the Commission. Why you actually support in one feedstock to one specific segment, whilst you know it's integrated the production? I just would love to see an impact assessment behind this reasoning.
Okay, so next question is for Dickon. This question is from Sean Delaney. As mentioned, the potential for energy independence for biofuels is an important factor. With this in mind, can you explain why EBB and the biofuels industry retracted its complaint for the EU investigation on Chinese imports of used cooking oil?
Yeah, sure.
Used cooking oil question.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. Because... It was perhaps a bit of a surprise. The nature of trade cases is you don't get to see a lot of what's going on during it because the investigators are very keen to get on and do their job and do their investigating without everybody knowing about exactly what they're doing. So that's part of the issue. The big problem we've got here in Europe at the moment is, and I don't say that lightly, I mean the big problem is imported biodiesel from China. We believe it is coming in a form that would be classified as being dumped, and it is what we do see is, and I'm not exaggerating, catastrophic in many areas result on the industry. So we had to do something about that. So where does the circumvention come in? When looking at the anti-dumping case, we're working with the Commission, and the Commission identified some routes which looked a bit odd. And we could see there was maybe a circumvention issue here. So the decision was made to let's have a look at the circumvention. Now, the very nature of the two different types of investigation are that one takes a long time, the dumping case, whereas circumvention, which is an illegal fraudulent act, is handled much quicker by the DG Trade. And so they felt, let's get on and do that, even though we know it's not the big issue for EBB in the industry. It's an issue which we want to get dealt with, but it's not the big issue. So let's get the circumvention going, and meanwhile, we'll progress the trade case. So the trade case is progressing, and we're hoping that's going to progress well, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that the complaint is going to be upheld come the summer. And there's potential for, you know, early duties and provisional duties and things like that, which will then have the effect, that the positive effect on the market. The circumvention case, if you looked at, if you're watching the trade flows, you'll notice that, for example, there was one particular hub in China where we thought, or the suspicion was, that circumvention was going through this hub, and that stopped. And then there were some other issues which meant that the DG Trade, in their investigations, were not going to be able to, although they discovered certain areas of fraud, they wouldn't be able to address it through circumvention channels. So it became apparent that the most pragmatic thing to do was to concentrate on the anti-dumping case. The effect of the anti-circumvention had already happened. There was a reduction in that flow. The flow of biofuel did pick up again, but we don't believe that's circumvented. So effectively, the circumvention case had done its job. So overall, to be most effective, it made sense for the industry to focus on the anti-dumping case and accept that the circumvention case had done probably as much as it could, and hopefully picking up the fraudulent issues and dealing with that through different channels.
Okay. I want to put the next question to Luke. This question is from Riley Cayeste. And it's about basically the definition of the different grades, first generation, second generation, all that. How do you see the grading of the level of technology, first, second, third generation, biodiesel, et cetera, combined with the feedstock sustainability? So how do we have the definitions right for the different grades right now? And how do you see that developing going forward?
Yeah, but personally, I'm not a big fan of speaking about first generation, second generation, third generation. I think what the Commission is doing in more conventional biofuel technologies and feedstocks and more advanced makes a little bit more sense. And also, I mentioned, you have the technology thing. So you have technologies which are known and technologies which still need to be pushed and which still need to go beyond their value of debt. I think that that's also other measures that you need to take there to support them. So you have to look at those two, and then you have to look at the feedstocks. And for my case, that's my opinion also, you shouldn't really look if it's agricultural crops, if they can be used for food, yes or no. I think what's most important is that it's a low ILUC risk feedstock. So really, making this distinction, I think it's also for a reason that farmers are growing crops that they know, because food crops and feed crops, because they know these crops, they have experience in growing these. So it's also a reason for that. So for that reason, I would say it's kind of an artificial distinction, and you should more look into, well, is this kind of competing? Is it high ILUC risk? Yes or no? I think that makes more sense to look at that from that level.
Well, to close out the panel, I want to put two related questions to you guys that have come in. They're really about the big picture here. They're about how we get the balance right between sustainability and the potential of biofuels. But there's also a question from certainly a biofuel skeptic here. So I want to get your responses to this. And Andre, I'll put this question to you first. So first question is from Shashrik Garg. How can the European Union strike a balance between fostering the growth of the biofuels industry to achieve immediate decarbonization goals while ensuring sustainable practices that safeguard both environmental integrity and food security in the long term? Second question from Livia Riparbelli. Do you really think that biofuels can be a solution for energy security without undermining food security? I don't think that advanced biofuels are a tangible solution, since many other waste-to-energy options are available, but still not exploited properly. So what would you say to how we get that balance right, and what would you say to people who are skeptical of biofuels?
Well, I think the first question is this famous million-dollar question, right? I mean, it's a lot of things in terms of balancing act. No, but let me start with the second one, in terms of the skepticism. I mean, I will look at it from the point of view of a regulator. And from my point of view, in terms of setting the regulatory framework right, in terms of better policymaking, for me, I think the key is actually not to exclude any possible options that can actually help us achieve goals. And leave, obviously, quite an amount of effort to the industry. Not to prescribe exactly what has to be done, but also let the industry innovate in this area and provide the environment. I think we all agreed here there is a role that biofuels can play. We can maybe differ in the assessment how much in different sectors, in different types of transport, et cetera, et cetera. But I think from my point of view, it's actually to make sure that by policymaking, this option is not excluded. That there is a possibility to make sure that this can be developed by the industry and leave also a huge part of it to the market. And well, that cannot be also sort of a link to the first question, but I think this is about more considerations to be put together at the same time. From my point of view, again, as a regulator, I think the key there would be to make sure that we have consistency. Well, I think we are quite clear in terms of goals on the European level, the high level goals and where we want to get in a couple of years' time, in 20 years' time. And then make sure that whatever we adopt, whatever we agree on as a regulatory framework or a policy framework is actually fully consistent in all these areas. And I think this also brings us to the discussion that we had earlier, that there are not different regimes put forward by different pieces of legislation. I mean, this should be our goal. Obviously, the Balancing Act is very difficult sometimes. It's very sensitive. We can then, you know, make sure that we don't only have legislation. We can work also on other parts. We have administrative procedures. We have also financial support. So I think this is really about balancing all these instruments that we have in place. But I think the key word there would be consistency and stability of that policymaking.
Dickon, how would you say that we can get the balance right here, particularly in terms of legislation?
I think that the core to this is what Andres mentioned, which is do everything. So the balance of legislation has got to reflect that. I don't think it does it particularly well all the time, but that is the aim, and that's what we'll keep pushing for. And there's I'll give you a quick example. And the question about, you know, is there really any role for biofuels? If you're talking about is there any role for biofuels in 2050, you know, fine, let's ask that question and think about it. But right here, right now, when every ton of carbon saved today is a ton you haven't got to think about tomorrow. And if you're doing it, you've got sort of 2 tons saved tomorrow. It's really important to do everything we can. And biofuels is what we've got a lot of at the moment and is making a big impact. So the example I wanted to say, for example, we've just had in the RED a change from B7 to B10 as the standard diesel. That's not implemented anywhere, there's work going on in certain places. B10 in the road fleet. And you might say, it's all going to be electric in a minute, so let's not worry. But it's not in a minute, and it's not everything. And if you were doing it today, that's a potential at least 40% increase in renewables versus fossil diesel in that fleet. So I'm saying, where's the legislation to help the national implementation of that B10 get that in there? And maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, when everyone's electric and the skeptics are all wrong about electric electrification, great. But then you've got heavy-duty vehicles. Same answer. We could be putting 20, 30%. HVO can go up 70, 80, 90%, 100%. You know, there's a lot that can be done with biofuels and have huge, you know, a B30 instead of a B7. That's quadrupling the carbon savings in a truck. Where's the legislation doing that? And we can do it tomorrow. Literally, you could do it tomorrow. So I do think legislation's got to think about what we can be doing now, because it always offloads the big problem that we've got going in the future.
Well, that brings us to the end of the time we have for today. Did you want to come in quickly, Zlatko?
No, just a quick thought that from a legislative perspective, we have to look at all sectors. So when you say, where is the legislation supporting B30, our colleagues who are working in maritime and aviation, they will not have any other options other than using the same feedstock to create SAF. So while maybe the light-duty vehicle can be replaced by a zero-emission vehicle, there is just not an option for aviation. So if we would have low ILUC and infinite supply, or close to infinite, we would be in different situation, but we will have various modes looking into the same feedstock at the same time. And the legislator, looking at the big picture, then has to look at the overall efficiency and how to help all sectors at the same time. But yeah.
Support is, and you mentioned the next legislative term will be implementation. But we miss one thing in this respect. We miss a mandate for the green chemistry. And if that could be repaired in the next phase, then I think we have this working vision that you were just mentioning.
Well, definitely a concrete suggestion for the next term. I want to thank all the panelists for some really interesting interventions. How about a round of applause for them? And thank you to you at home and to the audience here in the room for following along. Certainly a lot more to discuss when it comes to the future of legislation covering biofuels. We've got a term full of implementation coming up, but who knows what types of surprises could be coming in terms of new legislation and new little tweaks to legislation, as we've heard here today. So thank you so much for following along at home. For those of you in the room, I invite you out to the reception outside. And for those of you following at home, I wish you a great evening, and we'll see you right here for the next Euractiv debate. Cool.